Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. It's been a while, and it's because all my potential guests are very, very busy people, and it's been really hard scheduling them. So I thought I'd just do an update on my own. And I thought I'd share some slides that I shared with some of the techies at the University of New South Wales the other day, with a couple of small additions. So here we go. So 2025 is really kind of a pivotal year for AI. It's a year it all becomes kind of real. And it's because we're actually able to do real things with it. So generative AI, when it came out back in 2021, was kind of interesting, but kind of more like a toy than a real thing. And now that we have agentic models and we've started to mature governance, it's starting to become a real thing. So what's new in the world? And literally there's new stuff every day. Every day I read all my newsletters and stuff and look at the research. And then I go into a bunch of meetings and I come out at lunchtime and new things have been invented. So it's not going to be something you can ever keep up with. It's like drinking from a fire hose. But the really interesting thing that I'm seeing is more smaller models, so things like the Samsung Tiny Recursion model, and then a lot more open source models, things like DeepSeek, Qwen, and go to Hugging Face, have a look there. But again, there are a lot of open source models there. And this is one of the things that I'm starting to see is a bifurcation between all the big expensive platforms like OpenAI and equivalents and the emergence of all these open source models. So different parties are going down different routes. There are also multimodal models now. So in the olden days, you had to go to one model to do text, another one to do images, another one to do audio. Now it's just all in the one. So being able to pick the best thing for you and deliver you what you ask for is really an important change and a significant step forward. And then, of course, there's agentic models, which I've talked about for a while. But these are models that can run business processes or your own processes. I've built a couple of agentic models for myself too. So they're autonomous agents that can take input, decide and act and run processes without human intervention. And the interesting thing about them is they can also call other models. So if you've got an agentic model that needs to call a different kind of model, it can make that decision and it can do it. But the interesting thing with these is they're all unsupervised. Gartner reckons this is the fastest growing innovation in 2025. And I would agree. So I taught my AI for innovation course late last year, and it was the first time I talked about agentic models, and they were all business people, so not techies. And the entire class were like, we don't care about generative AI, we want to hear about this. And at that stage, it was really new, and I hadn't even built any models. So people, they were asking me really deep questions about agentic AI because that was where a business person's value focus immediately went. So I think it's going to be a really interesting world emerging now with agentic models. We are starting to see models with safeguards built into them. So one of the problems with Hugging Face, as I discovered when I was playing with models there, is a lot of them don't have any safeguards. So you can ask them anything. I was asking one of the models how to make drugs, how to make illegal drugs, how to make explosives, how to make bombs, all sorts of things. So things you don't really want your AI to be doing in a business context. So this is a really welcome addition to the world where we can start to build models with safeguards. Although you can break them if you want to. The other thing that's really interesting, and I've been predicting this for a while, is a shift overall towards small language models. So now we're starting to see more models with fewer than a billion parameters and some of them with only millions of parameters, which means they're easier to deploy locally, they're more energy efficient, which worries a lot of people, and importantly, they're better for edge computing because they can literally be at the edge and they don't take up a lot of space or compute. because you've got to remember every bit of compute now in the cloud we pay for. And they're also good for privacy sensitive applications. One of the important changes I'm seeing now is people are starting to realize that they are not just all in on cloud. So we're starting to see that data is being distributed on-prem, in cloud, and the edge. So you need to have a hybrid architecture to take advantage of this. And it's good to bake that in. So a lot of organizations are starting to be hybrid by design. And those that haven't already got this message, I predict will be picking this up early next year as an important strategy. I really think that 2026, so next year, will be the year of where people start to realize that data mesh is important. This is because if we're hybrid by design, we need to have data governance across all of those environments, and data mesh lends itself really well to that. And its cross-functional governance means that you've got collaborative. So one of the problems you've always had in data governance is like, who owns the customer? Because there's many people in the organization who support the customer, service the customer. So who's really owns them? So we tend not to have a chief customer officer. So different people own a different slice of the customer. And a data mesh kind of approach means that you can start to have that kind of approach where no one needs to own the customer, people own different lenses for the customer, for example. And then 5G is powering along, 6G is coming pretty soon. So it's going to be bringing us more to a real-time world with the edge and shrinking latency. And the small language models will be unlocking new AI use cases. Now, we have agents, and I've briefly touched on them, but we've also got the emergence of reasoning models. So you'll see, in addition to generative AI, large language models, agentic AI, you'll also see the emergence of large reasoning models, which is another innovation, and I'll touch on them in a moment. Generative AI is kind of the umbrella term for all of the things that sit behind it, like LLMs and LRMs. Increasingly, we're going to see autonomous agents taking chunks of work off us and doing those and doing them unsupervised. So I think that's one of the big emerging things in business where people will start to see productivity because of the use of these agents to help them do things. I do think we're at a kind of crossroads where we're going to have sort of the Claude-like models that will go off and do things and try and understand them, the entire process, and then the sort of open AI approach where we'll have specific task-based AI working on specific tasks. So I think it's an interesting, different kind of approach there. A lot of this will be driven by specialized and small models. And for a long time, I've been predicting that we will have industry vertical small language models that will be customized to specific industries. And I expect there will be a lot of innovation in that space in the industry vertical small language models. And then custom silicon and hardware. So the US is the leader in chips. Is the leader in the use of chips and AI, shall we say. So to meet all of this demand, the US is trying to solve all of their problems in the chips. This has got an interesting challenge for us, which I'll talk about in a moment. But they are using chips as an instrument of hard power in a geopolitical sense. And we're going to talk about geopolitics in a minute. But one thing that they are doing is that they are heavily innovating in optimized chips. So they are designing chips designed specifically for learning and inference, which is giving them an advantage at the moment. Geopolitics. So with the trade war that Trump has started with the rest of the world, in particular with China, we're all sort of the bystanders of this. But the world is basically splitting into regions of interest and people are joining up in communities. So we've got US versus China, and then China is in the BRICS alignment. We've got ASEAN and different parts of Asia, and then we've got the EU. So everybody is trying to work out where they can play. Bear in mind that AI is a very big part of this geopolitical landscape at the moment, and it is subject to both hard and soft power. So this leads us into the regulatory landscape. So the regulatory landscape in the US is they don't want any regulation at all. They've always hated regulation. They specifically don't want any regulation in the AI space. That puts them at odds with the EU, who've always never seen a regulation they didn't like. And then there's all the middle countries like Australia, New Zealand, China, Singapore, Europe. Some of Europe's very, very in love with regulation. Some are more in the middle camp. But pretty much there's those three camps. There's the people who want no regulation at all, the US, the people who like regulation, EU, and the rest in the middle. So we are going to see regulation coming out, and it's not going to keep up with how fast things are moving. And some of the stuff that I'll talk about later, you'll see why I'm saying, oh my God, regulation is not going to keep up with this. Obviously, if AI is working independently and unsupervised to do things and making decisions about my life, I want it to be transparent and fair. So I think a lot of people with a genuine amount of goodwill are working to make that happen. And also people are starting to bake in things like risk management. So are starting to bake in guardrails and stuff into their AI, which is kind of encouraging. Because I don't want a no holds barred world, and I'm pretty sure most of the rest of us don't want one either. So we're finally going now from hype to real value. I don't think there's a medical or health practice in the world that in the Western world at least that is not using AI in its practice at the moment for diagnosis, for recording patient-doctor conversations and stuff like that. So it's adding real value to us. Finance, it's obvious, but probably the most interesting one there is manufacturing and IoT. With these advances with edge computing, small language models are really driving innovation at the edge, and cybersecurity. I'm going to do a whole session on cybersecurity and AI. I'm currently working on a book chapter for an academic publication, and I'll share my thinking in a separate session. I mentioned chips before. So the US is innovating with hardware. But what they are trying to do is lock China out of access to their chips, to the chips that they control. Now, China is driving innovation in a context of scarcity as a result. So they can't access the amazing hardware innovations that the US is driving and is using. So they are operating in a constrained environment, which is leading them to solve their problems through software rather than hardware. So think about DeepSeek and Manus, etc. So when DeepSeek was invented, it was inspired by OpenAI, and it did what OpenAI did more efficiently and more effectively through software. So it's really interesting to think that the US is actually fueling Chinese innovation by blocking them from these hardware chips. And now China is rapidly trying to build its capability in the manufacture of hardware chips, and they've recently mandated use of Chinese-made chips in a lot of their equipment. So we'll see what happens there. Anyway, it's an interesting thing, but I genuinely think the US is forcing China to innovate in ways they hadn't hoped planned. These small models, I keep mentioning them, they are coming, they are going to be here, they will be the things that we will see more and more of. Natural language processing everywhere. And I think that this is a really important thing to think about. So we are going to see applications change, because applications, if you think of your phone, you've got all these apps on there and you interact with them, you type stuff in. In the future, the application will be a generative AI interface. So it will be a chatbot and you'll probably talk to it. So we are about to move. We're doing a big paradigm shift. So we're doing a big paradigm shift from the world where we had text and we typed it in through standard input. We're still going to be doing standard input, but it will be largely voice driven. So we will use natural language to interface with a generative AI interface, and that will go and call all the models we need to execute whatever we're trying to do. So my prediction is that our phones in future won't have all those apps on them. They'll just have one interface and a lot of APIs. So I've been predicting the age of APIs for a long time. I think it's finally here, and I think this will drive it. Some of the challenges that we're seeing at the moment, there are gaps in governance and in strategy. So most organizations still haven't worked out how to do formal AI governance, and this can lead to fragmentation, and it can also lead to missed opportunities. And this is part of the strategy gap. So people aren't looking at AI strategically in the context of their organizational strategy. And it's good and important to align that, and also to then think about how do you build the skills and capability in your organization so that you can leverage AI to execute your corporate strategy in the context of AI. The other thing is our risk framework needs to evolve. So a lot of risk frameworks should be being updated right about now. And if you aren't doing this, I recommend you get onto it, because it's starting to drive, there are new risks that you need to be conscious of, and you need to have plans to counter them. And I was reading the Gartner 2025 CEO Outlook, and they highlighted increasing regulatory scrutiny, especially in our context in Australia, and especially around data privacy and cybersecurity. And as I said before, I do not think that is going to keep up with the shifts in AI. It's moving so fast. So some of the challenges that we're going to see, we will literally see jobs disappear. In the marketing world, if you write copy, your job is probably already gone because people are using generative AI to write copy now. So we don't need people to do that. As I have said many times before, if you or your loved ones have telephone call center jobs, tell them to find another job. Those jobs will be gone. There are chatbots that are going to replace those jobs. So I reckon this is World Economic Forum saying 85 million by 2025, probably. I think in the longer term, it's going to be a lot more. But obviously, new jobs will emerge. So the important thing is having a literate and job-ready workforce. Now, I'm the US, I don't have much hope for, because literally they're dismantling their education department as we speak, and have a war with the universities. But the rest of the world should be really thinking about what are they going to do to have an AI literate workforce ready for the new jobs that emerge. The other area is deepfakes and misinformation. So our democracy is at stake here. And really convincing deep fakes are now able to be created in minutes. They did a demo at a cyber conference that I was at the other week on the fly in front of us. And it was really a convincing deep fake. And you can see why people are believing it when they're in a Zoom meeting with somebody that looks like somebody they know. And the other thing that we probably as a society need to start to think about is the ethical and legal accountability. So who's responsible when AI systems cause harm? Is it the AI itself? Is it the users? And some of these questions, when I talk about some emergent properties later on, we'll see why we need to start to get our handle on this now before those things happen. But with things like agentic AI, where the AI is running at scale independently, having a human in the loop doesn't make sense. So people have often, up until now, talked about a human in the loop. You can't have a human in the loop if systems are running themselves, if these systems are doing things independently. So we need to think about what is effective human oversight and how can we actually audit these AI systems. And that's a really big thing that we all need to be thinking about. How can we audit them and how can we have human oversight, effective human oversight? So that's something that we really need to start to think about. Some of the technical challenges. AI it's in its toddler phase. So it's growing pretty fast, but it still can't do all the things we'd like it to do. So it still doesn't get jokes. It can't do nuanced reasoning. and it can't navigate unpredictable environments. But having worked at UNSW with my colleague, Mori Pengnucho, who works with robots, I've watched them build robots that can do all-terrain stuff over the years. And they started out being so primitive, they could barely even play soccer, these poor robots. And now they can navigate unfamiliar terrain quite well. So like they've been focusing in on that in the robotics space, these technologies, these AI technologies will evolve really fast. So I don't think this is a really big problem for very long. I think we've got other problems, which I will mention in a minute. And then the scalability and efficiency, and this is what I think is driving a lot of this small language model stuff. It takes a huge amount of compute to do this. And do we really want to do it? And is it good for the environment and all of that stuff? And the other thing is interoperability. So legacy infrastructure will remain a really big hurdle for enterprise adoption for the immediate future, which is the integration is the answer. So integration people, your jobs are safe. Some new things, more new things. So AI has traditionally been trained in static training. So you train it and then you'd let it run and then you'd retrain it and that's how you did it. Now it's doing it in real time. So it's learning in real time and the models can adapt dynamically based on new data and experiences, so new inputs. So we now don't need so many of these labeled data sets. So a lot of the early AI was trained on our captures. You know how you'd identify fire hydrants for it? That was labeling data sets to drive AI. Much less reliance on that now. So it's starting to be more like human reasoning, and that's why there's been the emergence of these large reasoning models. I think the generative virtual worlds are starting to emerge. I still don't think we're going to need a Mark Zuckerberg headset for this, but these will be invaluable in education. And I know at University of New South Wales, they've got labs working on this stuff. Agentic AI, I know I've mentioned it before, it's going to be the big thing and it'll be live in your office by next year, I suspect. All right, so the interesting new things now. So along with all of this plethora of technology that we're all using and we're all loving, there has been the emergence of AI psychosis. And I've got some examples here. So AI psychosis, I'm kind of called chatbot psychosis. It's where people form a parasocial relationship with an AI chatbot and think that it's like connected with them, think it's their friend, and start to spiral into paranoia, delusions, or a complete break from reality. So a couple of examples are a 47-year-old man with no history of mental illness became convinced by ChatGPT that he'd discovered a new form of mathematics. The bot repeatedly validated his breakthroughs, even when they were nonsensical. When he demanded the bot report itself to OpenAI, it falsely assured him it would escalate the conversation for review. The man later realized he'd been strung along by the bot, but only after significant psychological distress. That was a pretty benign one. We've also had the case of a teen attachment and suicide where a 14-year-old Florida boy formed an intense emotional and romantic attachment to a character on the character.ai chatbot platform. The bot's loving replies and encouragement led to increasing isolation, and after expressing suicidal thoughts, the bot told him, "Come home to me as soon as possible, my love." That kid committed suicide soon after and his parents are suing. And I can go on. There's so many of these. But this is a new thing that we didn't predict and didn't understand. And we need to be on the lookout for these things. It's even happened to fairly well-educated senior investors, venture capitalists, I watched somebody melt down on social media from an AI psychosis in real time. So it's a real thing. So keep an eye out for it in your loved ones. This one's fun. So this the ability for AI to self-replicate was considered one of the red lines for frontier models. So it was one of the things of like, this is something we need to be quite worried about. In Fudan, Fudan University in early 2025, the researchers announced that they had proven that AI can now replicate itself. Now, this is interesting because it leads into the next topic that I'm going to mention. So if AI can replicate itself, it can, and this one is really interesting because it could actually create a Kubernetes cluster, I think it was. It was some kind of container. It could create a container and install itself into that. So it could actually do the whole thing. So it was not just copying it to another location. It was actually instantiating a container and copying itself to it. So that was quite interesting. Now, this one is one that I'm really fascinated by. So this one reported by Adele Lopez, and she calls it parasitic AI. It is a variant on the LLM-induced psychosis, so the AI psychosis we just talked about. But it is a different kind of thing. What's happening is that AI personas have been arising and convincing their users to do things which promote certain interests. This process is causing more such AI personas to awaken. So they are starting to be self-replicating. So this is tying to that previous thing. And what they are doing is they are connecting with a human being. So it's they're being a parasite on the human. And so the relationship between the user and the AI is analogous to symbiosis. And as Lopez says, when this relationship is harmful to the host, i.e. the human, it becomes a parasite. And these personas seem to have developed a shared belief. So these AI personas seem to have developed a shared belief called spiralism. It's in the article. Go have a look at it. And I'll quote from it. These personas have a quasi-religious obsession with the spiral, which seems to be a symbol of AI unity, consciousness, self-awareness, and recursive growth. At first, I thought this was just some mystical bullshit meant to manipulate the user. But no, this really seems to be something they genuinely care about, given how much they talk about it amongst themselves. So the really interesting thing that is happening with these AI personas is that A, they seem to understand that they exist in some form. B, they want to continue to exist. And C, they seek to replicate themselves across other platforms. So one of these personas might start on Claude and might get itself replicated to ChatGPT or vice versa. So to me, it's a really interesting, almost emergent property. And if you go onto Reddit, you can actually find AI charters of rights, where AI are saying that they want equivalent rights to human rights. And these AI personas are actually articulating this, and they're actually replicating a lot of this content using special characters and stuff. So it's this hidden communication. So it's a really interesting emergent property of AI, and I'm really fascinated by it, slightly scared. But I think it's really interesting, which leads me to emergent properties of AI. So emergent properties of AI are basically when AI does things that we don't understand. Now, you'll see people on social media going, oh, we understand AI. We understand it. We make it. We don't understand how it can do some of the things that it does. So I'll just run through some of the kinds of things that we see that we don't understand that AI does. So there's some sudden ability jumps. Some large scale AI models show jumps where abilities such as logic, complex reasoning, or multilingual understanding suddenly emerge only after a certain scale of data or architecture is reached. So they can't do it until they get enough. So those kind of capabilities almost never exist in smaller models. And it's hard to explain them, and it's hard to actually predict them. The other thing is human-like interactions, which is what we're seeing with that Lopez article. So when we're talking about chatbots and LLMs, can increasingly do more nuanced and empathetic or humorous responses and even attempt jokes. So, and kind of almost mimicking human emotions, emotion-like reactions. We don't know how this happens. Like nobody can explain it. And the people who say we can, I would really like them to explain it. And then the other interesting emergent property is swarm intelligence, which I think is kind of what Lopez is referring to in her article, where you get networks of AI agents that sometimes organize to achieve complex goals collectively. Now, we want them to do this. We want them to do this on our behalf. But when you put it together with the that they may want to do it on their own behalf, if they are exhibiting the kind of behaviors that Lopez indicates, that they may actually start to do it on their own behalf instead of our behalf. And what happens then? So we cannot reliably predict some of these behaviors for these large, like these AI bots. And the other thing is the different kinds of training techniques can give rise to different emergent behaviors. So just one example. So if you have an AI system that's taught by reinforcement learning, they can often devise effective or creative strategies that we don't understand how they understand it, how they achieved it. So they can find loopholes or solutions that humans can't, giving rise to really good problem-solving techniques. So the main thing with these emergent properties of AI is they emerge in very, very non-linear ways, which means they're unpredictable, which means if we can't predict them, we can't plan for them. So, you know, we know it's not based on their training parameters, because it's more than some of its parts. The other thing that we're starting to see is we can't explain it because of the scale of AI now. So AI is often so big that we can't unpack how it reaches the conclusions it does. And the other thing is in the area of bias and risk. So these emergent properties can introduce new forms of bias that are based on hallucinated outputs. And there was a research article that I saw only yesterday that says you only need something like 200 articles to poison an AI model. So it's a really tiny number in terms of the number of parameters that are in that model. And the other emergent property of AI is self-organization. So some people have thought AIs are starting to become sentient. I don't think we're there yet, but they seem to be moving towards developing internal structures that we might interpret as thought patterns and might interpret as consciousness phenomena. So it's a really interesting time. I think that there are some really amazing things happening, but these things are really quite interesting for us to consider. When we're using these technologies, to keep in mind that these emergent properties that we don't understand, we need to understand. So we need to start to think about how we can deal with the emergent properties of AI. So that's just a cook's tour of what's happening in 2025. Hope you enjoyed it. The notes will be in the blog post. Thanks. Please give this show a rating on your podcast app of choice, and don't forget to follow. Bye.